Today is Monday, October 16th. We're going to work on muscle contraction review, and we'll finish up this chapter today. Okay, so let's take a look at page 83. We're going to review excitation-contraction coupling. This sounds like a date, doesn't it? Excitation meet contraction. Okay, so we got to have excitation first. It's how we get the muscle aware that it needs to contract. And you can't really have contraction unless you first excite the muscle. So these two things are in fact coupled. The contraction process follows excitation, and that's when we talk about the sliding of those filaments, and we describe contraction as a sliding filament theory. And I think it's important to pay attention to those words, because the way we shorten and contract a muscle is not by bunching up any of those filaments, but by actually allowing them to slide past one another, thus the name, that sliding filament theory. Okay, so I want to repeat some of the parts with you, go back through the process one more time, make sure we're starting to feel a little more grounded with the process. Anybody still need the slide? All right. So let's start by talking about how you tell a muscle cell to get excited. And so we need to examine a motor unit and a neuromuscular junction. A motor unit's the big picture. This is a motor nerve or neuron that stimulates a bunch of muscle cells. So the message that comes from this motor neuron to all of these muscle cells is, hey, you contract. And because we want them to contract together, we want them to contract as a unit. That's why we call this picture a motor unit. These muscle cells are all stimulated at the same time by our motor neuron, and they'll contract together as a unit. Could you imagine how your body would behave if every one of these muscle cells in the motor unit did their own thing? You'd be twitching and, you know, wait a minute, you know. Okay, so that wouldn't work very well if they did their own thing. We want them to do their thing together, right? And if you zoom in, each individual axon terminal stimulates an individual muscle cell. That relationship is called a neuromuscular junction. Okay, and turn it sideways, and you'll see that these neuromuscular junctions actually don't touch. There's actually a bit of space in between that we call a
synapse.
Good, synapse or a synaptic cleft, good. So in order to excite a muscle, we need to zoom in on what's happening here at the synapse or the synaptic cleft. And that involves the release of a neurotransmitter to tell that muscle cell to get ready to get excited. That neurotransmitter is?
ACH.
ACH, good. So let's start by letting a nerve impulse travel down this neuron. It travels into your axon terminal. And in order for us to release these little sac-like vesicles of neurotransmitter, what ion must come into that axon terminal?
Calcium.
Calcium, good. And now, let me distinguish. This is not calcium stored in your muscle. This is calcium that comes from your interstitial fluids. This is blood and fluids that circulate around these cells. So we get that calcium. It comes into this axon terminal, and that prepares these vesicles of neurotransmitter to exit by exocytosis. They rupture like little blisters, and out here in the synaptic cleft, these little acetylcholine molecules exit, and they travel across the synaptic cleft and bind to what? Sodium channels. Yep. Good. Bind those sodium channels, and when ACH binds a sodium channel, that sodium channel
opens.
Good. Opens up, and now what happens to your muscle cell? Gets flooded by sodium. Sodium comes rushing into your muscle cell. That is excitement. Good.
Okay, so time out.
Okay.
I just had to dance for a second, so you might have said this, but so where's the sodium coming from, though?
That sodium is also in the interstitial fluids outside your cells, bloodstream. Okay.
So once the ACH binds to the sodium channel, that's what
comes out. Yeah. Channel open, sodium floods in. And if you have enough sodium flood in, you've got excitement, and that muscle cell takes over from there. Okay? Do you feel pretty good about excitement? Are you excited about excitement, right? Okay, so let's pinpoint some questions here. What ion has to enter your axon terminal in order for us to release vesicles of neurotransmitter?
Calcium.
Calcium. Yeah, calcium. And the excitement allows the neurotransmitter known as blank, ACH or acetylcholine, to travel across your synaptic cleft and bind to receptors on blank channels.
Sodium
channels. Good. Okay. And once acetylcholine binds a receptor on a sodium channel, that channel opens. And what have we now achieved in our muscle cells?
Excitement.
Excitement. Good. So that excitement then leads us to the next phase, which is contraction. So let's go back and look at a different picture. All right, so now we're inside a muscle cell, and we got to kind of think about blocking out what we just went through and now focus on that muscle cell. Once inside the muscle cell, this excitement tells your sarcoplasmic reticulum to release calcium. Yeah, that calcium is stored inside your sarcoplasmic reticulum. It is going to leave. It's going to travel into your sarcoplasm. And when it travels into the sarcoplasm of your muscle cell, it now binds to a particular part of your thin filament.
Troponin.
Yeah. Binds to troponin. And when calcium that was stored in your SR binds to troponin, what happens to the rope-like tropomyosin?
It
reveals binding sites. And those binding sites are on what filament? Actin. Yeah, those binding sites are on the actin filament. So notice these two pictures. How do you know the top picture is not ready for muscle contraction? Good. I heard two things there. Calcium is not bound to troponin. That is one. And you're right. The second issue is that rope-like tropomyosin covers up your binding sites. And if you cover up your binding sites, what can you not form?
Contraction.
Yeah, cross bridge. So we can't get the head of the myosin molecule to bind if you cover up those binding sites. Likewise, the bottom picture is ready for contraction. What is the clue? Good. There's two things. You're right. Calcium has bound to our troponin molecule, and that has moved our tropomyosin rope away from those binding sites. And these little black spots here are meant to be our binding sites for the head. Good. Those myosin heads will reach up. They'll attach to those binding sites. And that allows for muscle contraction to begin. So kind of taking it a step further, we looked at this animation in class on Wednesday of last week. We know that when the binding sites are revealed, that myosin head can bind and form a
cross bridge.
Good. It pivots, causing those thin filaments to slide. What is that pivot called?
Power stroke.
Good. So what is the importance behind sliding those thin filaments? Why do we need to slide them? So the muscle can contract, right? So as you start to pull those filaments will slide, and that will cause the Z lines to move closer together, yeah. So the catch here is that we need calcium to help us reveal binding sites and allow for these cross bridges and power strokes to occur. So every time that head releases from its cross bridge formation, what powers the release?
ATP.
Good. And so when you're finally done with muscle contraction and you no longer need the muscle to stay in a contracted state, what should you do to this calcium bound to troponin?
SR?
Yeah, store it back into the SR. And the SR, what is that?
Sarcoplasmic reticulum.
Yeah, and it's an organelle that wraps around muscle fiber known as myofibril.
Yeah.
So to kind of give you the big picture, these are all myofibrils here. And this thing that looks like a lacy sleeve, that is called your SR. That's where the calcium is stored. I would understand, let's see, that picture with the myofibril and this one here. And also we talked about endoepiperimycium.
Yeah.
That one, yeah. That one's on there.
So the
Yeah, because I was asking you to identify the endoepiperimycium, one of those three. Yeah. Okay, and then of course sarcomere, parts of the sarcomere, that's a multiple choice as well. When you're no longer interested in having a muscle contraction occur, we've already talked about restoring that calcium back to the SR. That allows us to cover up binding sites on our thin filaments. Let's go bigger. Let's go back to that excitation process. If we're no longer interested in exciting the muscle cell, what do we have to stop doing? Yes, stop releasing the neurotransmitter, stop letting sodium come into your muscle cell. So how do we get rid of acetylcholine out there in the synaptic cleft?
With the ACHE.
Yeah, that's it. ACHE, which is acetylcholinesterase, what a name. That is an enzyme, right? And it recycles your acetylcholine back up into your axon terminal. So when acetylcholinesterase, or ACHE, ACHE comes along, it prevents acetylcholine from binding these sodium channels. What do you think happens to those sodium channels? They'll close up. And if you close those sodium channels, does your muscle cell stay excited?
No.
So what happens to your muscle cell?
It starts relaxing.
Starts relaxing, right. So we've got to have acetylcholinesterase in order to cause that muscle to go back to its relaxed state. So if you don't, what happens to your muscle if you have no acetylcholinesterase? Contracted, yeah. Keep that muscle in a contracted state. Okay. Starting to feel a little more comfortable here. Okay. Let's run through the animations one more time. So what they're showing us is a neuromuscular junction. Big picture, this is the motor unit. That is the one neuron and all the muscle cells it's going to stimulate. When they zoom in on this, you're going to see those individual axon terminals and the parts of the muscle cell or muscles that they stimulate individually. So the relationship between one axon terminal and the individual sarcolemma of your muscle cell, that is called, that space is the synaptic cleft, and the relationship here is the neuromuscular junction. Okay, we just watched an action potential travel down that axon terminal. That action potential is going to allow for ions to flow into your axon terminal. They are calcium, good. So we see calcium channels allowing calcium to flow into that axon terminal, and that prepares vesicles to leave. What are these vesicles full of?
ACH.
ACH, good. Where does ACH now go?
To the synaptic cleft.
And binds a? Yes, binds a sodium channel. When ACH binds a sodium channel, what happens to the channel?
It opens up.
Good. And by the way, these green things are sodium channels. This other stuff is the sarcolemma of your muscle cell. The little black dots there, that's of course ACH. And now what's rushing into your muscle cells?
Sodium.
Good. This influx of sodium into your muscle cell creates a positive environment that is called excitation. And if you look closely when they zoom out, down here in darker blue, that is our SR, and these are our T tubules. The nerve impulse travels down that T-tubule. Bam, it tells those SR to release calcium, and now we're ready for the next step, which is contraction. That's the next story. That's going to be nerve impulse transmission. But potassium leaves when you've got sodium coming in. It's an attempt to reset you back to a resting state. Yeah, but that's, we're getting there. Chapter 11. Why is acetylcholinesterase necessary? Yeah, stop it from contracting. Let that muscle cell relax. It allows for us to close what channels?
Sodium.
Sodium, good. And where does acetylcholine go when it's been recycled?
Axon terminal.
Back into that axon terminal, good. Okay, so let's now take us to the cross-bridge cycle. This is part of that sliding filament theory. You can see in this picture they've already got calcium bound to troponin. Why is it important for calcium to bind to troponin? Good. Let tropomyosin reveal those binding sites. And so we're ready for contraction in this picture. Because that binding site is available, the myosin head reaches up and forms an attachment with it known as a cross bridge. Good. All right, so what happens once a cross bridge has occurred? Good. That's power stroke, which moves and slides that thin filament. Okay, and we're going to repeat the process over and over. So to release that head, we have to power it with?
ATP.
Good. Or if we were this slow, we'd be slower than sloths, you know? You'd eat like once a month. You might move a half inch over the day. Okay, and then the head is now repowered into what they say is a cocked position, and it's ready to repeat, pull, and slide, detach, repeat, until we start sliding those thin filaments closer together. And one important thing to appreciate, which is those filaments slide, but they don't bunch up. And by sliding, we're going to move those Z lines in what direction?
Closer
together. We just lost our H zone right there through the middle. And now we've got our H zone back because we're going to start letting this muscle cell relax once again. So in order to relax, you have to remove the calcium from the troponin. Yep, and that causes tropomyosin to cover up those binding sites. Good. So once you cover the binding sites, can you perform a cross bridge cycle? You're done, right? Okay. So if you were to tell this story right now, how much of it do you think you could get out?
The excitation.
Excitation.
If part of the contraction.
If I coach you along, you feel comfortable with me coaching you?
Yeah.
Okay. But if I turned it over and said, okay, now you're on the spot, you would not quite. Okay. Why don't we do this? I've got a puzzle for you, and it's got the steps of both excitement and contraction, but they're all out of order. So this is a way for you to kind of practice getting those steps in the right order. Do pay attention to the first clue and the finally clue in the middle of the paper, and if you want to work with a buddy, feel free, and then we'll do answers in just a few minutes. Okay, so excitement is steps 1 through 6. Contraction is steps 7 through 11. Now you've got an outline that you can take and cut it up. You can put it in order. You can shuffle it and put it back in order. You can even make your own notes from it. You can write your own story from it. So I hope that by giving it condensed to you on one page, now you've got all 11 steps right there, albeit out of order, but nonetheless, you can use them to kind of guide your practice for the next couple of days.
Yes.
Because there is a lot of overlap, and it makes it feel like they go hand in hand. Yeah. And it will take time to get them to separate out. Okay. On Wednesday of last week, we covered the blanks on pages 83 and 84. I just want to make sure there weren't any blanks there that you needed. Any blanks that you need on pages 83 or 84? Okay, over on page 85, there's more for the sliding filament theory, and then about a halfway down the page there, you'll notice step 4 talks about isotonic and isometric contractions. What we've been describing so far is called an isotonic contraction. This kind of contraction means that the sliding filament theory is at work, the filaments slide, shortening of the muscle occurs, and of course contraction occurs along with that. So it's exactly what we've been describing so far. I need to make sure that you understand there's a different kind of contraction called an isometric contraction, and that one is a little different in terms of what we're looking at. First thing I want you to pay attention to is there's an iso as a prefix for both terms, but metric sounds to me like a meter or a length, right? Okay, so iso is same, meter or metric is length. Isometric contractions do not change length. Isometric contractions do not change length. You ever carry really heavy bags into your house, maybe from the grocery store? Okay, you can carry those grocery bags and you feel your muscles bulk up on your arms, right? So what's happening is when you're carrying those heavy bags, the length of your muscles is not changing. You know, you're not doing anything to flex or extend those muscles. You're simply just carrying a heavy bag. That's making the myosin heads lock on to those cross bridge formations. But what are they not able to do? Move and pull. Yeah, they can't move and pull, so they're locked in place, and so that's what we consider to be an isometric contraction. Once you walk in your house and you lift up those bags to flex your arms and you sit them on the counter, now you've done an isotonic contraction. So in that case, you've actually let those myosin heads do what? Yeah, let go of their activation sites, attach again, pivot, pull, slide, release. That is what we consider a normal muscle contraction. So besides carrying heavy bags, what are some other examples of isometric contractions that you can do?
Use down weights.
If you just walk with the weights by your side, that could be isometric, but if you flex, you've done isotonic. What about leaning against a wall? You can push hard as you can, right? Do your muscles change length if you lean and try to push the wall down? Isometric once again. Standing takes isometric contractions. If you're simply standing upright, you have to have some muscles in a slightly contracted state all the time. If you didn't, what would happen to you? You'd fall, yeah. The muscle wouldn't maintain muscle tone, right? So a lot of your muscles are in constant isometric contractions to make sure that you sit or stand upright. And if they fail to do so, then yeah, you fall over. So isotonic contractions actually produce shortening of the muscle. Isometric contractions, there is no shortening, okay? So that is the difference between the two. Isometric contractions do not shorten. Isometric contractions do not shorten. Isotonic contractions, however, do shorten. We talked about relaxation on the middle of your page, so I'll just let you reread that if you need it. And at the bottom of your page, this is on the bottom of page 85, how do smooth muscles contract? Okay, so smooth muscle contraction is similar to skeletal muscle, to cardiac muscle. The only thing that's different here is that we notice there are no banding patterns. The striations are missing from smooth muscle. Striations are important for skeletal and cardiac muscle contractions, but not here. So we notice that the contractions for smooth muscle are long-term. They don't get tired over that time period. And of course, they are involuntary, like cardiac muscle contractions. So there's a type of squeezing that occurs in our smooth muscles. What is that rhythmic contraction called?
Peristalsis.
Good, peristalsis. And in what organs do you find smooth muscle?
GI tract.
Esophagus. Blood vessels. Urinary tract. Okay, so to push out a bowel movement, you know, you're using peristalsis. You're using your abdominal muscles to create pressure, but you're having to rely on peristalsis and your smooth muscles of your lower GI. To urinate, you're looking at peristalsis there. You know, for blood to move through our vessels, for lymphatic fluids to move through our lymphatic vessels. This is all an involuntary contraction of our smooth muscles. Good news is these muscles don't tire as quickly as skeletal muscles, so they can contract over longer periods of time. All right, so that should wrap it up for the bottom of 85. That's a couple of meaty pages there. Do y'all have questions? Anything I can clarify for you? If you like, we can repeat the whole story of excitement and contraction on Wednesday and next Monday. That way the story starts to get cemented into your brain. So now that we've talked about contractions, let's talk about how you make a contraction stronger. You know, it takes more strength to pick up this table than it does to pick up something like the little remote control. So the strength is what we're looking at now, and we can increase muscle tension by increasing the number of motor units that we activate. It doesn't require but a few motor units to pick up a lightweight object. It may require many more motor units to participate to pick up a heavy object. So what we're talking about now are graded responses, and I thought I would take you through the parts of a muscle twitch first, okay? Just putting this out there ahead of time, muscle twitches are not the normal way for our muscular system to operate. When do you normally experience muscle twitches?
When you overwork the muscles.
Sometimes when you overwork a muscle?
Yeah, spasm.
Something like a spasm?
Seizure?
Kind of like a seizure, yeah. You ever been really stressed out and had a twitch? And you swear that everybody knows you're winking at them. Okay. So, and when the stress eventually goes away, then the twitch usually follows suit. If you're really tired, you can have a twitch for, say, weeks or months on end. When I have a 10-year-old, and when I was pregnant with her, I had a twitch for, I think, the last 6 months of pregnancy. When she was born, the twitch went away, you know, but, you know, it was all around the eye, and, you know, that's so annoying, right, to have a little tiny muscle twitch in some part that just nags the heck out of you. So normal times, muscle twitches accumulate and produce a contraction with some strength behind it. But, you know, it's easy for us to examine the parts if we simply look at a twitch. So you'll notice that this muscle twitch is measured in milliseconds. Just to kind of put this in perspective, that's less than 1 second. So that muscle twitch that nags the heck out of you, less than a half of a second, okay? Right here at the beginning is what they say is a stimulus. That is the release of acetylcholine from an axon terminal. That stimulus is the release of acetylcholine from an axon terminal. And you have what's called a latent period. That gives us time for the acetylcholine to travel across the synaptic cleft and bind to sodium channels, yeah. And once acetylcholine binds a sodium channel, that sodium channel opens up, and what floods in?
Sodium.
Sodium, and if enough floods in, we tell that SR to
release calcium.
And the calcium travels from the SR to a molecule of troponin. When we bind troponin, what happens next?
Calcium.
Good. Let those tropomyosin reps move, reveal those binding sites, and now that the binding sites are revealed, those myosin heads can reach up and form
cross
bridges. Now you are moving into the contraction phase. All of that story we just told was less than five milliseconds. Boy, that's insanely fast. During the contraction phase, what are those myosin heads repeatedly doing? Power stroking, releasing, cross bridge. Good. Over and over, right? So that pulls and shortens those muscles performing isotonic or isometric contractions.
Isotonic,
good. And then eventually the acetylcholine goes back to your axon terminal thanks to an enzyme called
acetylcholine.
Good. XCHE or acetylcholinesterase. The sodium channels will now
close.
And then of course the calcium that was binding to your troponin molecule gets stored back in the
SR.
Good. And we're almost done, because when you store the calcium back in the SR, what happens to your rope of tropomyosin?
It covers
the binding sites. You no longer can now form a
cross bridge,
right? Now, you're in the relaxation phase. It takes more time to clean up this mess than it did to make it. So you'll notice that we're looking at about 20 milliseconds there for all of this stuff to be restored back to our resting state. Nonetheless, a muscle twitch is less than a half of a second. That's an incredibly fast period of time for all of these events to unfold and then get cleaned back up. What normally happens is not muscle twitches by themselves. What we typically do is we take multiple motor units and we say zap with acetylcholine, and we zap fast enough that we don't give that muscle time to clean up and relax. What you see next is called TREPI. Some textbooks call this like, we're getting there, we're kind of summing up those twitches, we're getting to the point that we're getting nerve impulses come faster and closer together. But what do you notice? These black arrows here are a stimulus. Notice how far apart they are. What are you giving your muscle enough of a chance to do?
Relax.
Yeah. Compare that picture to the next one. Notice those arrows come even closer together, so your muscle tension is doing what? These are your tension peaks.
Going up.
And you're giving your muscle less time to fall back to a relaxed state, so you're zapping that muscle so fast with acetylcholine that you say, hey muscle, contract, but don't fully relax. That is what we normally experience. It's something that we call unfused or incomplete tetanus, or sometimes they call it like summation of twitches. Okay, so it's an incomplete or unfused tetanus, sometimes called the summation of twitches. This sounds like Halloween. Summation of witches, summation of twitches, okay? So when you pick up your pen to write, you are doing unfused or incomplete tetanus. We do not want to experience the last picture, which is called fused or complete tetanus. Notice those arrows indicate stimuli coming really fast, giving your muscle cell no opportunity for
relaxation.
Yeah, and what happens to the tension?
It rises.
And so that muscle stays in a locked, contracted state with no opportunity for relaxation. You ever had a muscle cramp?
Oh, yeah.
There you go, right? Okay. So you stretch your legs when you're in the bed, get a muscle knot. That's a fused or complete tetanus.
I had a couple of
contractions.
Is that too?
What's that?
When you're having a baby, labor, okay. Contractions, is that the same as that?
It's summation.
It's summation?
It's still summation, yeah. Yeah. Fused or complete tetanus is a muscle that contracts and cannot relax. And those pregnancy and labor contractions go through periods of contraction, and then they go through a period of relaxation. So the contraction may be a really hard one, but it is going to come back to a relaxed state afterwards. that the reason it's so painful is because you've got many motor units syncing together and doing a contraction, as opposed to just like one or two when you have menstrual cramps. Yeah. I know you probably heard somebody tell you not to walk in the yard with bare feet because you can step on nails and you can get lockjaw tetanus. Yeah, you ever heard that? Okay. So soil contains a bacterium called Clostridium. If you have any open cuts on your body and you happen to come in contact with Clostridium, that bacterium can get into your bloodstream. So oftentimes, you know, people tell their kids, hey, don't run around barefoot. You can get cut by a rusty object, rusty yard tools, rusty nails, whatever. And that bacterium gets into your bloodstream and releases a toxin. Well, that toxin actually encourages fused or complete tetanus. So what does that mean we are doing at the axon terminal?
That means that it keeps on sending the ACH down into the muscle.
Yeah, keep on sending ACH to the muscle. It binds those sodium channels open, sodium channels let sodium come in, and that SR constantly releases calcium. Yeah, constantly releases calcium. So muscles never get a chance to relax when they experience something like Clostridium toxins. So
they lock up,
exactly. You know, if you think about 1940s, about the time that antibiotics came out, anything prior to that, you know, you were just at the risk of your immune system either healing you or not. They say that back during previous wars, like say the Revolutionary War, the Civil War, if you were shot and that bullet had Clostridium on it, you might have died, and you might have lived through it. They said the lucky ones were the ones that died. That sounds pretty awful, doesn't it?
There was very much like the Civil War in level two. I mean, like the medical practices were so medieval to the point where you'd be better off dead.
Yeah, because otherwise you would suffer with this for like 3 months, they say, before you healed from it. Yeah. So apparently it took a long time for your body to fight off that toxin and kill the bacteria. You can see this guy is like writhing in pain. His muscles are locked up, and if your diaphragm locks up, what can you no longer do?
Breathe.
That's how they died. So, you know, nowadays we can treat this with an antibiotic to kill the bacteria, and we also get a tetanus shot to prevent this bacterium from releasing its toxin or building up in the bloodstream. Yep. This is one of our two poisonous spiders in this state. This is a prime time for spiders out in the yard. They also like to live in your garage or in dark corners of your closet. Yeah, they everywhere. So if you are not familiar with the Black Widow, take a look at her red hourglass. That is a great warning sign. Yeah, hourglass of death.
I have one of those living in my air conditioning unit outside. Well, not unit, but the air conditioning.
Spray it good.
I haven't yet.
She probably won't come in, but yeah.
Been down there for a while.
Black widows release a toxin. That toxin also increases the release of acetylcholine. And if you release more and more acetylcholine into your synaptic cleft, what does your muscle cell respond by doing? Contracting, yeah. So once again, if your muscles stay contracted, they are in fused or complete tetanus, and they have no opportunity to
relax.
There you go. So if someone does have problems from black widow bites, it's oftentimes respiratory because the diaphragm cannot contract and relax like it's supposed to. And so people may end up with pneumonia or other respiratory disorders. And in a worst case scenario, it could cause you to no longer be able to breathe. So pretty dangerous little bug there.
Amazing that it's so tiny because so deadly.
Yeah, seriously. I'm sure you've heard of Botox before. And so I think it's kind of cool. They've got a map of the human face where they can inject Botox to prevent wrinkles, you know, classic laugh lines, you know, brow furrow here. And they also use Botox in the armpit to stop sweating. So if you're a... Yeah, if you have...
I had it in my palms for sweating.
Yeah, that's what it was originally made.
Yeah, then you can do it there too, yeah. The bad news is it only lasts about 6 months, so if you do use Botox, you have to use it again on a fairly frequent basis. And you'll notice it decreases acetylcholine release. So without acetylcholine, how do muscles respond?
They relax.
They cannot contract. So, you know, your muscles around the face then pretty much stay in a paralyzed state without acetylcholine. By the way, this comes from a bacterium called botulinum. You know, it's botulism. That's the same thing that we can get if we can vegetables and fruits improperly. So that's another bad reason for botulism. It can cause muscles to basically stay in a relaxed state. Paralysis. So let's talk about muscle recruitment. This is actually, we're gonna have to flip over a page. Yeah, underneath your myogram up there near the top, you'll notice a phrase about recruitment. Okay, so top of page 89, you'll notice right below the myogram, there you've got recruitment. Let me explain recruitment this way. If you're gonna move and you have the entire task of moving your household by yourself, no way, right? You need to recruit some friends to help carry the load, and that's exactly what muscles do. If you have a light load to carry, only one of these motor units may turn on to do the job of lifting or muscle contraction. If you have a very heavy box to carry, you may turn on all of those motor units, and they're all going to stimulate muscle cells. So it's just the more power you need, the more motor units you recruit to help you do a job. Now, you can have motor units turn on and turn off. If you've ever carried something that's a little too heavy for you, you've probably said to your friend, hey, I'm going to drop this, here it goes, and you drop it, right? So what happens is you realize that when you're getting ready to drop something, these motor units are getting tired. They turn on. They turn back on. They turn off. They turn on. And eventually those motor units say, I'm done. The muscle won't respond anymore. And then the nerve is stimulating that muscle. But what will it not do? It won't contract. It won't accept that stimulus. So unfortunately, motor units can just turn off and say, hey, done. Let the muscle rest until you can recover.
So that's what causes you to drop.
Yep, get so tired they don't work, and they won't listen, they won't turn on even if you stimulate them. And that is called muscle fatigue when that happens. And we'll actually get to that term a little bit later.
Is that when lactic acid starts producing?
It is when lactic acid starts producing, exactly, good. Just a couple of things next down there. I thought you'd be interested in knowing about slow and fast fibers. Just real briefly, I'm going to tell you about those. If you eat chicken meat, you know that there's dark meat and light meat on chicken meat. And we associate more moisture with those dark meat muscles than we do with the light meat. Sometimes people say the light or white meat on a chicken is rather dry. So there's actually a reason behind this. That dark meat is structured differently than is the light or white meat. And we actually have both types of muscles on our bodies as well. The fast twitch fibers on our bodies are considered the white meat. Not that we're into eating people, right? But, you know, we've got fast twitch fibers that respond quickly. And you'll notice in this picture, these fast twitch fibers are anaerobic, which means they don't need oxygen to work. They have explosive power, but they get tired really quickly. On a chicken, where's the white meat?
On the wings and breasts.
Yep, there's breasts and wings. So let's say that you've got chickens in a yard, a dog runs into the yard, those chickens have a burst of flight, just enough to get them away from the dog, and then they're done, right? Okay, so it's just enough to keep them from being eaten or torn up by a dog, and so that's what the fast twitch fibers on our muscles do. On a human, you know, if you are a sprinter and you have to be the fastest out of the gate and the first to the finish line, you're going to have more fast twitch fibers, okay? By contrast, these slow twitch muscle fibers are aerobic. Aerobic means they use oxygen. And the way they store oxygen is with a molecule called myoglobin. You may notice that one on your worksheet.
Myoglobin stores oxygen and it makes the tissue a darker color, thus the name dark meat. Notice that these slow twitch fibers are actually smaller in diameter, and they have endurance over a longer period of time. So I know a lot of you are currently working in hospital or medical environments. A lot of you are planning to go in that direction. And if you stand on your legs for 10, 12 hours a day, guess what kind of fibers you're gonna develop in your legs? Slow twitch, yeah. So if you're standing, you know, and your muscles need to endure over, say, 10 or 12 hours of being worked, those are the slow twitch fibers, okay? So going back to the runner again, a fast twitch is going to be a favorite for a sprinter. What kind of runner should have more slow twitch fibers?
Marathon
runners, exactly. So if you're going to endure a longer run, you've got to have the slow twitch fibers. Okay, so, you know, if you watch the Olympics, you may look at the bodies of a sprinter. They're very muscular, and that's because fast twitch fibers are bigger around. Those sprinters that run just a few meters are going to have bigger muscles. Look at the marathon runners. How do their bodies compare?
Slender.
Very slender, yep. So it's the fact that the slow twitch fibers are actually more narrow in diameter than those fast twitch fibers. So kind of some cool stuff there to know about those different kinds of muscles. Let's see, last thing down there is hypertrophy and atrophy. What can you do to hypertrophy a muscle?
Work out.
Good. And what can happen to you to atrophy a muscle?
It's smaller.
Yeah, you don't use it and you lose it. So you put that muscle in a cast, or maybe you're constipated. Those kinds of things can encourage atrophy of muscles. So they are in fact opposite. Hypertrophy is exercise and use. And then disuse atrophy means those muscles shrink in diameter.
Also, too, Ms. Patty, is that right here? Some bulk of muscle that can be stored or rebuilt. So basically, whenever our body builds a muscle, they have to keep the muscle and then it rebuilds itself.
That can make it bulkier and bigger, yeah. That takes some time, so that's why if they're working a body area, they'll work beyond what they can handle, let that area rest for several days, and then work another body area. You've got to give it time to rebuild. It's a slow healing tissue. Yep.
So if you didn't, that's what causes the muscle to get torn through and not be able to repair itself properly?
Yeah, if you keep working it after it's been torn, it's going to cause damage, scar tissue to build up there. So our last page of content for muscles has to do with ATP generation. And we know that ATP is necessary for muscles to contract. We talked about one very specific time we need ATP during contraction, and that is to power the release of what? Myosin head, good. There's other times ATP is necessary. So we know that ATP is a critical component of muscle contraction. So what I'd like to do is tell you a little bit about ATP and how we can generate ATP for muscle contraction and relaxation. Okay, so first of all, ATP is adenosine triphosphate. It is our energy molecule, and tri means we have how many phosphates?
Three.
Got three, okay. One way to make adenosine triphosphate is to take ADP, and that D stands for how many phosphates?
Two.
Two, good. And you can find a phosphate group to join you and give yourself three phosphates. So basically, ADP is two, find yourself a phosphate, give yourself a high energy form called ATP. ATP is like having money in the bank. It allows you to do work. And when you do work, you actually take off a phosphate group and you use it like a credit card. And then, of course, you can do work like muscle contraction or protein pumps, things of that sort. If all you've got, though, is ADP, this is like having no money in the bank, and you have nothing you can do work with. So ADP is not the form that you want to have. You want to have money in the bank, which is ATP. Okay? There's actually three ways to make ATP. One way is to do it using aerobic respiration. This is classic cellular respiration, and the term aerobic means that you're not exercising, but rather you're using what ingredient?
Oxygen.
Yeah, you're breathing air, you're using oxygen. So you may want to highlight on your worksheet that aerobic respiration uses oxygen, and look how many ATPs you can make from one glucose molecule, about 36. You may want to highlight that as well. You know, if I had to choose a way to give me the best gas mileage for a glucose molecule, this is the way to go. You know, 36 ATPs off of a single glucose is really efficient, and this is your body's preferred way to make ATP when you're resting. By the way, where do you get the glucose from?
Sugar.
Sugar that you eat, right? Okay, and if you don't have enough glucose, you're going to burn off fats. You're going to burn off glycogen, which is a storage form of glucose. It can burn off proteins. The only other thing you cannot burn off is though, on nucleic acid. You can't turn DNA and RNA. That'd be kind of detrimental, right? You can't turn DNA and RNA into sugar, but everything else can be. Okay, so the next way to make ATP is this one here. It's a really fancy long name. It's called direct phosphorylation of creatine phosphate. We'll just keep in mind the second step is CP, or creatine phosphate. The only time you can really make your 36 molecules of ATP from glucose is when you're resting. The minute that you start to get up and leave the classroom today, you're going to require more ATP to power your muscles than you have made at rest. You really can't store a whole lot of ATP, so your body says, okay, now that you're packing your book bag and leaving the classroom, I'm going to switch on creatine phosphate. And that only gives you about a 15-second boost of ATP as you start to exercise. And packing up your book bag is exercise, okay? So you'll notice that we're not using glucose or oxygen at all this time. We're actually using creatine phosphate found in your muscles. You ever heard of taking creatine phosphate supplements? Mm-hmm. What do they give somebody?
A
burst of energy. Yeah. So the reason they would take that is to give yourself a burst of energy, because this is a kind of a short-term temporary way to make ATP. Notice that you only make one ATP. So, you know, you can make 36 from a glucose and oxygen, or you can make one from creatine phosphate. There's no competition, right?
No.
So resting, you use aerobic respiration. You make around 36 ATP per glucose molecule. If you have a little bit of exercise, like getting up to pack your bag, you can supplement for about 15 seconds with creatine phosphate. And then if you realize that you were running late for work and you made haste to the parking deck or the parking lot out back and got your car, When you start really increasing that exercise, you're now going to switch on a third type of respiration, and this one is called anaerobic respiration. This will help you to supplement your ATP production, because if you're hurrying about, you're not going to be at rest and have a higher demand for ATP. So notice when you do anaerobic respiration, you actually start breaking down glycogen supplies. I'm going to go way back in your brain here. Back in chapter 2, where do you store glycogen?
In your liver.
Liver and your
muscles.
Muscles. Good. And if you burn through your glycogen supplies, then what do you burn off? Fat. Yep, burn off the fat. So at this point, when you're doing anaerobic respiration, you're going to burn through your glucose first. You'll then burn through your glycogen storage supplies second. And then you're going to go after your fat and your protein supplies third. But notice, this is not a great way to make ATP. You only make around 2 ATP per glucose molecule anaerobically, meaning we don't use what? Don't use oxygen. So when you start making glucose anaerobically without oxygen, your body says, hey, you're cheating me. You're only giving me 2 ATPs per glucose molecule. If you can start breathing enough oxygen in, I can convert back and do aerobic respiration. Why is that the preferred mechanism?
Because you produce more ATP.
More ATP, yeah. So, you know, when you're in anaerobic respiration, like if you decide to run to your car today, then you're going to be breathing heavily because your body says, give me oxygen to make aerobic respiration and 36 ATPs. So until you can get enough oxygen back into your system, you're going to experience something called oxygen death. And you're going to breathe heavily until you can restore that most efficient aerobic respiration process. And so that's actually what's at the bottom of the page. If you're in oxygen debt, you're repaying off that anaerobic process to get you back to aerobic respiration. And like we talked earlier, if you happen to have, you know, something that impedes you from making enough ATP, your muscles will completely fail. So, you know, not enough blood, not enough oxygen, not enough ATP for your muscles. You're carrying that heavy box for a friend and your muscles say, I've had it, I don't have enough ATP, for instance, anymore. They're going to cycle off and basically fail. And at that point, even with stimulation, what happens to your muscles? They will not contract, right? So if you overuse your muscles, this is the kind of the end result there. What got darker and darker in here, didn't it? Like nap time. And guess what? That is it for this chapter. Yeah, so we are ready for nervous system come Wednesday. It's going to be a rerun. You're going to hear a lot of the same story again. So if you have a chance to pre-read, we're heading into nerve impulse transmission come Wednesday. All right. Y'all have any questions, any blanks there that you need help filling in?
Can we do some questions in the middle?
Sure, we can do those. About dead center of page 90, which of our three types of ATP productions makes the most?
Aerobic,
good. So that first bullet point, aerobic respiration makes the most ATP. The next question there says, makes the least? If you want to make it simple, you can call it creatine phosphate. But yeah, direct phosphorylation is the fancy word for it. That second bullet point makes the least ATP is creatine phosphate. Third bullet point, anaerobic respiration makes lactic acid. You've probably felt this if you get like a side stitch if you're running. You get pain on your muscles if you're climbing the stairs. Your muscles say, stop, I ain't going no further. That's that lactic acid. You stop and you breathe, you'll get rid of the lactic acid.
Slowly.
Yes, slowly. You can't move again until it's gone, right? Let's see. Turns glycogen into glucose. What do you think?
Anaerobic.
Anaerobic, good. Hey, if you want to lose weight, that's the way to go. Anaerobic respiration. Exercise will burn off your glycogen, then it will burn off your fat. Kayla.
How much did you say to lose one pound of fat you have to, you said it last?
It's, I want to say 3,250 calories that you have to carb off your diet. But you know, you also got a basal metabolic resting rate, so, but you basically have to get rid of 3,200 calories. I think that's about the right number to kill a pound of fat. Yeah. That's a daunting thought.
Yeah.
Let's see, used during rest is?
Aerobic,
yeah, and when you start to move, yeah, creatinine kicks in when you start to move. And used during heavy exercise?
Anaerobic.
Yep, anaerobic, good. All right, well, I'll see you guys on Wednesday. Yeah.